Now, just by way of definition, just to sort of get us going, I'm going to use Lawrence's definition of pornography, which is doing the dirt on sex. There's various other definitions of pornography. Kenneth Tynan used the one. It was just, pornography is just anything which is written in order to produce an erection. That was his definition. Anything which is produced, in other words, really just for masturbation. But I think Lawrence's one is as good as any, doing the dirt on sex. Now, what I want to do is look at, and we can discuss that later in terms of definition, because there should be plenty of time for discussion. What I want to do is just look at the background to the growth of pornography and the proliferation of pornography in our society, and to find that there are some limits to that, but generally to see the scale and nature of the problem. Then I want to see the case that is built up against pornography, which is increasingly becoming conclusive and persuasive, and one which is being taken seriously, even in those quarters which one thought might not listen, which isn't most encouraging. And then see, thirdly, how we as Christians can be involved in fighting in pornography in a constructive and helpful way, because it is, I want to argue, something which is extremely damaging and unhelpful for our society in all sorts of ways. Okay, the background to how pornography has proliferated. It's not just a recent phenomenon. The first court cases that deal with pornography back in the early 18th century. But really, of course, it's with the invention of photography in the 1830s, 1840s, that you get the growth of pornography. And Victorian pornography was no mean thing. It was in the Holywell area of London that the pornography industry was situated in 19th century Victorian London. And it was really quite extensive. It then was increased, though, very much after the Second World War, when you got the availability of cheap colour printing. But the interesting thing, up until about the 60s, for the most part, pornography was something which was fairly furtive, fairly under the counter, something which was not, as it were, publicly acknowledged, recognised, or given any sort of exposure to. With the 60s, of course, with the growth of the whole 60s permissiveness, pornography began to become publicly respectable or acceptable, something which was available in every high street. And this was a result of the whole sort of style of permissive thinking, which argued, amongst other things, that if you were going to have political liberation, you needed to have sexual liberation. And in order to have sexual liberation, you needed to have absolutely no restraints, and that the price, if you like, of sexual freedom was to allow pornography to come in. Pornography on the whole wasn't approved of by the whole sort of 60s permissiveness, but it was seen as being something which was to be allowed and not to be restrained. And it was interesting to see this sort of thinking which allowed it. There was a film called W.R., The Mysteries of the Organism, which, as it were, paid tribute to the work of William Reich, who argued for this, that you needed sexual liberation as a precondition of political liberation. Therefore, we should have sort of no restraints on any sort of publication. And I remember the left sort of, and the liberal left sort of holding this as being important and being against any kind of censorship. Any kind of censorship was regarded as being unthinkable. Respectable liberals wouldn't agree with any kind of censorship. Otherwise, it was treating people like children. It was wrecking art. And after all, pornography, after all, was something, was possibly therapeutic, was possibly helpful for people. And this was the kind of conventional wisdom of the 60s and of the whole permissiveness, which, as it were, gave pornography this public acceptability. I remember having my doubts about this, that somehow pornography enabled political freedom, at least sexual freedom, enabled political freedom, and pornography was a necessary part of this, when you started getting Rupert Murdoch producing The Sun, and when you started to get the professional commercial pornographers moving in and exploiting all this, because it was becoming perfectly clear that instead of sexual freedom leading to political freedom, as the left wing had it, it was these right wing people like Murdoch who were exploiting this and who were these right-wing people who weren't the sort of people that respectable liberal opinion approved of, who were capitalizing on this freedom and producing all this kind of pornography. And in a curious way, instead of sexual freedom leading to political freedom, pornography was being used as a sort of opium of the people. It was being used as a way of just keeping people happy, you see. It was interesting how this concern for freedom was actually wasn't going to produce the goods that people thought it was going to produce. It wasn't going to produce the kind of political freedom that people hoped on the left. It was going to be people on the right, people like Murdoch and the professional pornographers, who were going to capitalize on this freedom, and were going to use pornography as a way of just keeping people happy and not making people free at all. But anyway, my point is that basically we get the public acceptability of pornography in the 1960s. Pornography was seen to be as something distasteful but basically harmless, and this was all very much expressed in 1970, when there was a presidential commission on pornography which produced its report. This was a presidential commission set up by Nixon, which came out with a view basically that pornography was not harmful. This was the majority view. And this had enormous influence and was picked up on by the liberal media as being the sort of cast-iron proof. Here is a right-wing president who has ordered a report to deal with pornography in the hope that it will demonstrate that pornography is harmful so that he can produce some sort of restrictions. And in fact, it has produced the opposite. It has, as it were, given the green light to pornography. And widely touted was the supposed results of what was going on in Denmark, which was quoted in the report, which was that Denmark had actually got rid of its obscenity laws in 1969, and that there had been no increase in sexual crime. Rather, there had been apparently a decrease in sexual crime. This was mentioned in the presidential report and was seen as being a reason why every other country, every other sort of right-thinking progressive country, should get rid of its obscenity laws, because quite clearly, once you got rid of the laws, pornography just became widely available. It was no longer on the black market. It was no longer associated with crime. People would soon get satiated with it and fed up with it and disinterested in it, and it would have no market effect on society at all. And therefore, all the fears of the people on the right, or the fears of the conservatives or Christians that somehow pornography was dangerous, were seen to be groundless. So it was that presidential commission did have a tremendous influence. Now, it was in this context, therefore, of general permissive thinking, licensed by things like this presidential commission, that you see a tremendous proliferation of pornography. And in this year, last year at least, in July the 1st, 1989, The Independent estimated, for example, that the girly magazines alone in this country have a trade value of £500 million a year, and that we therefore see pornography on film, in the newspapers, in that appalling thing called Sunday Sport, not worth the name of newspaper, of course, in videos, in computer porn, which is now very worrying because it's so unrestricted and unregulated, and pornography on the telephone system. And you see it not just, you see it sort of in every part of the high street. Dear old W.H. Smith, Menzies, and all these people have their quite crass pornographic magazines. And these magazines are no longer the girly magazines, they're no longer the sort of glamour pinups of the 1950s. They are really pretty depressing stuff, sort of gynecological stuff. Really degrading. So we see a tremendous proliferation of pornography, and arguably a lot of the stuff is getting worse. And some people say that 1992, with an unrestricted European market, the problem may well even get worse still. Now, I don't want to exaggerate it and rather suggest that absolutely nothing has been done, because there has been some limitation. Even the 1959 Obscene Publications Act, which we can discuss later in discussion, even though it's very inadequate, because it has a criteria that somehow you've got to prove that pornography has corrupted and degraded people, which is a very difficult thing to prove. Even though it is inadequate, it does actually set some sort of limits. At least we have that. We have also the 1978 Children's Protection Act, which prevented the use of children in pornography. We also have had the 1981 Indecent Display Act, which prevents the public display of pornography, so that now when you're in London, you very often see a shop selling pornography with the front window blacked out. And it's not, as it were, available. It's not so visible in the windows as it used to be. We've also had the 1982 Local Government Miscellaneous Provisions Act, which has enabled local authorities to decide whether they have sex shops or not, and many sex shops have closed as a result of that. We also have the 1984 Video Nasties Act, you know, the act that deals with, that regulates videos, and that has got rid of some of the worst ones. And last year we got the establishment of the Broadcasting Standards Council, and later this year we will have, with the Broadcasting Bill, the extension of the Obscene Publications Act to TV and radio. So there has been, what I would say, is a restriction on things getting as bad as they are in some other countries. But despite that, I think we still do have a problem. The stuff that is widely available on the high streets is, to my mind, quite unacceptable. And there has been a degree of public concern about this. I think, generally speaking, that the whole sort of permissiveness that licensed pornography in the past is now generally less accepted. Permissiveness is seen in some senses to have gone sour. And many people, women, recognize that the streets are less safe to walk on than they used to be. And it is thought that pornography has a part to play in this. And as a result, you have had the campaign against pornography with their off-the-shelf campaign. We can perhaps discuss that a little bit more in detail. And a quite definite attempt to try and limit pornography, which is bearing fruit. And again, we can go that into discussion, because I've actually had some contact with the campaign against pornography and what they've been doing. To the extent that Paul Ferris, in a very recent couple of articles in The Observer, made the rather sort of feeble Observer joke. I don't know if poor chap, whether he's responsible for, or his sub-editor, is that Ms. Grundy marches on. So there is, in other words, the feminists are coming out against pornography, and he thinks that something's going to be done about it. But it's an indication of the fact that there is a degree of public disquiet about pornography. And I think this provides Christians an opportunity to do something and to argue vigorously against it. In a curious sort of way, Christians are fighting the whole abortion thing very much on their own. But I think that in the same way as with Sunday trading, Christians were able to find allies in all sorts of other areas, like in the trade unions. In the fight against pornography, I think Christians can find allies in other areas, for example, amongst the feminists. And again, we can discuss that. Now, the reason why people are beginning to really take pornography seriously is that the case against pornography has really started to build up. 20 years ago, if you said that you were against pornography, you were seen to be just making a statement of sheer prejudice and of distaste. There was, it was said, absolutely no evidence that pornography did anyone any harm. There was very little evidence that pornography had any effect at all. But in fact, that is now not the case. After 20 years of seeing pornography widely available, people are beginning to see that it does have an effect. Now, what I want to say is that, first of all, it's now perfectly clear that pornography does have an effect. You cannot claim that it has no effect. After all, sexual therapists use sexually explicit material for reasons of therapy. For example, sexually explicit material is used to help homosexuals by some therapists to change their orientation. Now, if that kind of sexually explicit material is used in that sort of context, it shows that sexually explicit material has an effect. You cannot say it has no effect. Equally, one can make the argument that if we invest a lot of money, as we do, in good art on the grounds that good art has an effect for the public good, it is nonsense to turn around and say that pornography, which in a sense is bad art, has no effect. If good art has good effect, then pornography, bad art, has bad effect. And so it is just not tenable to say that it has no effect at all. We live, after all, in a cause and effect universe, in a moral universe, and the things do have an influence. Now, I think also other people, and Eysenck made the point, the psychologist, that pornography is, in some senses, in its format and the way it's produced in magazines and films, very similar to the kind of material you see in advertising. Everyone grants and accepts that advertising has a huge effect, that's why people spend money on it, and therefore to some extent, in the same way, pornography is going to seem to have similar kinds of effects. Now secondly, there's increasing evidence that not only does it have an effect, but the effect is harmful. That the effect is harmful. And I want to look at four groups of witnesses, and this in a sense is the nub of what I'm saying, four groups, or the core of what I'm saying, is four groups of witnesses who testify to the harmful effect of pornography. And these four groups will be those people who are experienced professionals dealing with in this field. That will be the first group. The second group will be with the academics who are investigating it. The third groups will be the feminists. And I want, as a fourth, not a group, but an individual, who I think tragically and ironically bears witness to the harm of pornography, and that is, in fact, Kenneth Tynan himself. If you don't know who he is, I'll tell you later. Does anyone not know who Kenneth Tynan is? You don't know. Okay. You don't?
I don't know.
Right. Okay. I'm getting older. That's what's happening. Or who he was, because, of course, the poor man is dead. He's not. He should be alive. He died of emphysema. Okay, now, let's look at the first group of witnesses, the professionals in the field who are arguing that pornography has harm. There was a parliamentary seminar last year, February last year, by Care Campaigns, in which they looked at pornography. And they had a number of speakers, and they included a chap called Chief Superintendent Ian Donaldson, who was head of the Obscene Publication Squad for 4 years, up until 1989. And he very clearly sees pornography as having a damaging effect on society. He made this point in answer to a question. Pornography actually stimulates the breaking down of inhibitions. It stimulates the breaking down of inhibitions. He was particularly talking about that in relation to paedophilia and child abuse, but that's how he sees it. That's his experience. And I think one has to take seriously the experience of people operating in the field. Then somebody else, also at the same seminar, but also I've heard at another occasion, is a chap called Ray Wire. Now, Ray Wire is a sexual therapist dealing with really serious sexual offenders. He's a director at the Gracewell Clinic in Birmingham, and he has written a book called Women, Men and Rape, which is co-authored. And he's dealt with the sorts of people who are locked away for a very long time. And his conviction is that pornography isn't what necessarily causes people to go out and commit sexual offences, because he sees that as being very much related to people's backgrounds, to them having been sexually abused, and it would be very hard to prove that pornography was actually the agent that caused them to do it. What he sees as pornography being really damaging in is that it maintains a belief system that treating women appallingly is somehow okay. If you see pornography in every high street retailer, in which women are routinely degraded, what can be so wrong about your degrading them? It, as it were, legitimizes your minor aberration. And he sees it as being profoundly damaging. He says this: what I'm going to talk about is how pornography, how newspapers, how the media, all are involved in maintaining offending behavior. And he went on to say, the one important factor with regard to pornography that you can't ignore is exactly the impact and effect it is having on men committing sexual offenses. And again, I think you have to take really seriously what people like him are saying. I've also read a book put out by a feminist, by Every Woman magazine, which is a transcript of the hearings given in Minnesota, where there was an attempt to produce a city ordinance banning pornography. And reading the transcript of this, these hearings, what was interesting, that all the people who were dealing with sexual offenders were saying the first thing they do when they're dealing with a sexual offender is go and find out his pornographic stockpile and get rid of it. They had no doubts, these people who had, as it were, hands-on experience, this stuff is dangerous and damaging. Okay. Now, somebody else who is also a professional, is also at this parliamentary seminar, is somebody called Diane Corr, who's been particularly involved in trying to deal with child abuse. She was responsible for setting up an organization called Child Watch, an agency specializing in preventing child abuse. And this is what she had to say during this seminar. She says, I've been working with children who've been sexually abused for many years and find that it's still the best kept secret, but the most destructive secret in our society. We live in a world where there are no moral boundaries anymore. We have no moral structure, and it is glamorous to live in an anything goes society. Well, is it? Do we really believe that we're happy with the state of affairs? The victims of sexual abuse don't. Soft porn, hard porn. Anything that distorts the attitude to our sexuality is dangerous. We are not letting our views and disgust known about the ready availability of porn in case we are called narrow-minded, straight-laced, etc. We've got to stand up and be counted. Now, it seems to me that one just cannot ignore the witness of these kinds of people, and I think it was very interesting. Those people who have seen some of the films by Dobson, he was involved in the Meese Commission in 1985, which was set up by President Reagan. And he argues that the Meese Commission produced a very, very different report from the one in 1970. The one in 1970, there's been a lot of criticism of. It was a very quick report. It was done with inadequate research. Whilst the one with the Meese Commission had a huge amount of evidence put before it. And the evidence overwhelmingly came out against pornography as being really harmful. And Dobson makes the point in his films extremely strongly that this is the case, that the Meese Commission, with very much more, this is the Attorney General's Commission set up by President Reagan in order to investigate pornography, and it very, very much, as it were, came out with a different view than the 1970 Commission. And that was... the Meese Commission was having a huge amount of evidence presented by all sorts of people involved in the field, and they were all coming out against it. So that's the experience of the first category I mentioned, the four groups of witnesses. That's the first one, the experience, the professional people in the field. Then there's the academics. There's a chap called Dr. Victor Klein, again from the States. And he's had a tremendous amount of experience in dealing with sexual offenders. And he's, as it were, identified what he sees as a sort of pattern of behavior in sexual offenders in relation to pornography. He sees it having sort of four stages. And his work was used in the Mies Commission, incidentally. He sees that people start, the first stage in relation to sexual offenders and pornography is that people start getting addicted. There's the stage of addiction. This is then followed by escalation. You need something stronger. This is followed then by the third stage of desensitization. You start to become sort of amoral and detached from what's being involved, that in fact you're looking at pictures of human beings. And the fourth and dangerous stage is the stage of acting out. Pornography by itself, what goes on in your fantasy world, is no longer enough. You want to actually try it out. And he says that in his experience of dealing with hundreds of sexual offenders, this pattern is fairly a definite pattern that he observes in their relationship to pornography. And there is, incidentally, a video called the Bundy video, which is being produced by CARE. Ted Bundy was a serial and multiple killer. And Dobson interviews him the night before his execution in Florida. And he very much substantiates this kind of pattern that Dr. Klein, argues for. So I think that in the academics who are actually dealing with therapy, Klein is a useful witness. There's another sort of category of witnesses. People who've done laboratory research on the effects of pornography. There are people like Dr. Malamuth from the University of California, UCLA, and Dr. Donenstein from the University of Wisconsin. In 1984, they produced a book called Pornography and Aggression. What they basically did was to measure, get a group of young people, students, expose them to hardcore violent pornography, and then try and find out if there was some kind of attitudinal change as a result of seeing this, to see whether they had a disposition which was more likely to aggress after seeing this kind of material. And overwhelmingly, they found that both for men and women, when they're exposed to violent pornography, it increased their predisposition to be aggressive, and that it did have an effect, particularly in relationship to violent pornography. So there has been some useful work in the laboratory, and that is just one part of, I could quote a huge amount of other research, which tends to support that, though it's still an open field, and I'll discuss that in a second. Then there is not so much, if you like, called the laboratory research, but there's a sort of social research which is being carried out by somebody like Dr. Court from Australia, who's produced a very good and useful book on pornography. He's the person who looks at, is there a relationship between permissive laws, laws which allow obscenity, allow pornography, and a rising rate of sexual violence. And he argues, in fact, that in general terms, where you find countries which allow pornography tend to show increasing sexual violence. And those countries which have restricted pornography, you see the opposite. And he particularly argues that in the case of Denmark, there was a massive misrepresentation of what took place. That in fact in Denmark, there was an increase of rape as a result of, or at least coincidental with, the banning of their obscenity laws. So, for example, he says in 1963 there were 173 rapes in Denmark, whilst in 1978 there were 484 rapes per year. And he argues that the reason why the figures were misrepresented was because in the sexual crimes, in the category of sexual crimes, all sexual offences were included, not just the hard and serious ones, but all sexual offences, things like peeping toms, things like people exposing themselves. And he argued that the reason why the total figure seemed to go down was that people in the more permissive climate no longer bothered to report these minor sexual offences. All right. And therefore it gave the impression that there was less sexual crime. But if you looked more carefully at the figures, you would see that as far as the serious crime was concerned, you got an increase that was taking place in Denmark. And he gave instances of other countries which are rather tougher on pornography, places like Singapore, Japan, South Africa, which tended to have less sexual crime, and countries which had been more open in the States, the UK, some of the states in Australia, which had been more permissive and seen a greater amount of hard case of serious sexual crime. So the second class of witnesses, the academics, seem to indicate that there is a relationship between widespread availability of pornography and sexual crime. In other words, pornography is clearly harmful. Now, one would have to say that not all of this academic research is completely conclusive. It's argued, for example, that as far as the laboratory research is concerned, that if you show people films of lions killing wild animal, killing game, in other words, a sort of very dramatically violent film, they will also show, because it's a very violent film, all right, they will also show a greater predisposition to be aggressive after they've seen that film. I've seen that argued, and therefore there's nothing particularly damaging in hard, violent pornography. It's also argued in relation to the sort of social research that that Court has done, that measuring the degree of pornography in any society is extremely difficult. How do you measure how much pornography is available? And then how do you measure whether there really has been an increase in sexual crime? Because everyone knows that all crime statistics, and particularly sexual crime statistics, are quite difficult to be certain of. You see, a lot of people argue that the fact that we've got increased rape statistics are because it's now much more commonly reported that women feel more confident about going to police to report it. So, for example, in the county that I come from Hampshire, there's been an increase in rape cases. From the mid-1960s, there were about 25 to 30 odd. And there is now sort of 70 to 80 a year. Now, when I spoke to the local police about this, they said that it was hard to say that this was because of pornography or because of permissiveness. They said that they had greatly improved the conditions under which women were going to be interviewed after sexual crime. For example, they would always see a woman police officer, whereas in the past they may have seen a man, which may have put people off. So people are now more willing to report. And this woman would always be not in uniform. And they even had bought a house, which provided the sort of context of an ordinary house where you'd go into a living room where you could discuss the experiences with a police officer, so you didn't feel that you were going to a police station. Do you see? Now, I think that therefore possibly people are more willing to report, but I think that what's much more compelling is the fact that the vast majority of women feel far less safe on the streets than they used to, and I don't think it's just a matter of better reporting, do you see? I think it is the fact that there is an increase of serious sexual crime. So though I think there are some, perhaps, uncertainties about some of this research, I think that as we get more and more of this research, we will find it pretty clearly demonstrated that there's a relationship between pornography and sexual crime, that it really is harmful. But I just want to point out that there's some difficulties of it. There is, at the moment, a Home Office report that's going to be produced by a chap called Cumberbatch and a chap called Howitt. The Home Office have agreed to review the situation in this country or all the academic literature and to try and work out whether there is evidence to suggest a relationship between pornography and sexual crime. And we'll have to see with what they come out with. However, one group of people who have no problems at all about pornography being harmful, who are not remotely interested in doing any academic research to prove this, are the feminists. They say pornography is like racist, is sexist, and sexism, and it's just like racism. It's just like racist material. In the same way as they say it's completely irrelevant and unnecessary to prove that a racist film or a racist book does harm, or a racist statement does harm, just as it's unnecessary to prove that it does harm, so with pornography it's completely unnecessary to prove it does harm. It is in and of itself offensive and harmful. It is in and of itself degrading of women. And it's absolutely pointless to investigate the harm that it does. We don't like it. We are offended by it. We find this stuff degrading. We find this stuff dehumanizing. And that is enough, period. And it's very interesting. They sort of cut through the usual sort of liberal defense of pornography and say that this is nonsense, that it does harm. So the feminists are the third group of witnesses which point to the harm factor of pornography. And the fourth group, or the fourth one, is this chap Ken Tynan. Now to reveal all, to tell you who Ken Tynan is. Ken Tynan was a director of the National Theatre. He was one of the people responsible for setting up the National Theatre. He was one of the most influential drama critics in the country in the 1960s that there were. He was the chap who managed to get the word F-U-C-K on BBC, the first person to do it. He was also the person who produced the first person to get sort of nudity on the stage in his review called O Calcutta. Who remembers O Calcutta? Do you remember O Calcutta? Which grossed $360 million, of which poor Ken Tynan got hardly any. He was a hopeless businessman, which is one thing to be said in his favour, but he didn't make money out of it. But Ken Tynan was an immensely influential person in the 1960s. He was one of the key spokesmen for the Permissive Society. He was one of the people who was most virulent in his attack on censorship. When theatre censorship was changed in 1968 with the Theatres Act, he was one of the people who had been most campaigning for this. And the irony, and he was an absolutely brilliant guy who wrote superbly, had a brilliant career at Oxford, and was really a very influential person in the 60s. Now, I don't know if you come across this book, Paul Johnson's book on the intellectuals, which is a review of a whole lot of... I won't go into that now, but anyway, he deals with Ken Tynan, amongst other things. And the interesting thing is how this apostle of permissiveness and of freedom was one of the most pathetic victims of pornography that you have ever come across. And all that, in a sense, Paul Johnson quotes is the biography of Ken Tynan by his wife Kathleen Tynan, which is a very tragic thing. And it shows how Tynan became completely obsessed with pornography. and with his sadomasochism. I'll just read this. The second marriage crumbled like the first on Tynan's insistence on total sexual latitude for himself and fidelity for his wife. He formed a permanent liaison with an unemployed actress with whom he enacted an elaborate sadomasochistic fantasies. Pornography is heavily involved in that, involving himself dressing up as a woman, the actress as a man, and sometimes prostitutes as extras. He told Kathleen that he intended to continue with these sessions twice a week, quote, "Although all common sense and reason and kindness and even camaraderie are against it, it is my choice, my thing, my need. It is fairly comic and slightly nasty, but it is shaking me like an infection, and I cannot do anything but be shaken until the fit has passed." Here's somebody, the apostle of freedom, absolutely caught up in this sort of sexual perversion, which was very much stimulated by his obsession with pornography. In 1964, I'll go on, he formed a relationship with Playboy. Though oddly enough, they resisted his attempts to provide them with erotic material. It seems to have been Tynan's optimistic belief that he could turn pornography into a serious art form, encouraged by the meretricious success of Old Calcutta. In the early 1970s, he tried to enlist a number of distinguished writers in compiling an anthology of masturbation fantasies, but got humiliating rebuffs from, among others, Nabokov, Graham Greene, Beckett, and Mailer. Thereafter, he became increasingly involved in a long, drawn-out, but ultimately abortive attempt to produce a pornographic film. And he goes on to quote, he wrote to Kathleen from Provence when he was then trying to write pornography himself to make some money out of it, because he thought he could sort of do something with it. He wrote to Kathleen from Provence, "What am I doing here? Churning out pornography. It is very shaming." At Saint-Tropez, he dreamed of a naked girl covered with dust and excrement, her hair shaved off with dozens of drawing pins nailed into her head. At that point, he recorded, "I woke up filled with horror, and at once dogs in the hotel grounds began to bark pointlessly, as they are said to do when the king of evil, invisible to man, passes by." That's a quote from Tynan himself, in a sense, you know, describing his own pathetic situation, caught up in this obsession and addiction to pornography, because this is very largely what it is. Tynan's last years, a sinister counterpoint of sexual obsession and physical debility, are movingly told by his widow and make appalling reading to those who knew and admired the man. They recall Shakespeare's arresting phrase, "the expense of spirit in a waste of shame." So that's my fourth witness, in a sense, to the damaging effect of pornography. That's not the only reason. Pornography is not the only reason for Tynan's sexual obsessions and sexual problems, but it's obviously that it fueled and exacerbated the problem very largely. He had a huge collection of pornography. So those are the four witnesses against it. I also want to say that, of course, that suppressing pornography, dealing with it, need not necessarily be against free expression. I agree that censorship has often been badly used and misused, very often under the guise of upholding public morality. People have tried to suppress political ideals, and at times censorship has just been downright stupid. There's a famous case apparently in South Africa, I hope it's not apocryphal, where they banned Black Beauty on the grounds that it was a consciousness-raising Black Power book. And of course one gets those kinds of instances, but despite the fact that pornography is sometimes at least sometimes the censorship has been badly used, and sometimes I would agree that it is sometimes difficult to draw the line. Overwhelmingly, I think that merely because it is difficult to draw the line as to what is acceptable material and what is not, that doesn't mean to say that we should not try and draw the line, and to draw the line in a very different place from where it is being drawn now. So I want to, since I noticed the Christian Institute is described as being equipping people to action, to encourage people to get involved. Okay, to encourage people getting involved in doing something about pornography, not feeling embarrassed or feeling somehow that one has to be the Mrs. Grundy type character, or feel somehow that one, you know, is just some sort of lone, crazy Christian trying to fight against these things, there is a really powerful case for showing that this stuff is demonstrably socially harmful, that this stuff is really damaging, and that it is worth getting rid of. And it's worth, I think, joining in the off-the-shelf campaign, which I can talk about in a minute if you like, which the campaign against pornography are involved with, even though one disagrees radically on lots of other things that the feminists are doing. It's worth getting involved in that. It's worth getting involved in care campaigns, picking up the pieces campaign. Because I think that pornography is demonstrably, it is harmful to society because it is so degrading to women. And I think it is also harmful insofar as it is undermining of marriage. It is really just institutionalizing lust, and it's something I think we can all do without. Okay. Any questions or comments?
What do you say to the argument that you say it's degrading to women, but the women who take part in it choose to do that? Mm-hmm. And you could argue that lots of other things in society are degrading to lots of other people in various ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that I wouldn't want to exculpate the women who involve themselves in this kind of stuff. I think the feminists are a bit naive at times in feeling that somehow all women have been forced into doing this, and that somehow it is male chauvinism which is responsible for women displaying themselves the way they do. I think that's nonsense. There's a lot of women wanting to make out a lot of money out of it. There's women who want to be, in the old-fashioned word, want to be quote-unquote wanton and want to display themselves, and that needs to be hit on the head. That needs to be dealt with, you know, just as much. But I think despite that the huge market for pornography is overwhelmingly that of men, and it is degrading for women, even though women, or some women are, as it were, guilty of being complicit with it.
Would you say that the doing down of people in other areas is incidental, but the degradation is a necessary part of pornography?
I was going to ask, actually, what other instances you could think of, but I mean, I think that it is not only it's necessary, it's the prime thing very often about pornography, that it is just reducing people as objects, to being toys, to being playthings. And that's what the really depressing thing about it.
Is the aim.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Whereas if people are dumbed down by economic pressures, and things, that's in pursuit of something else. It's not actually setting out to do that
right.
To people.
Right.
It's a prime motive.
Right. Right.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking, just to take an absurd example, someone might make a complete fool of themselves, on television, something like that. But they're doing it because they want, it's actually degrading what they are as humans by being so stupid and that. But they're doing it because they want to be, do you see?
Yes.
Mind you, making a fool of oneself, I don't think it's necessarily degrading to your humanity. It might be actually a witness to your humanity. any other?
How would you ally degradation in pornographic terms to degradation of language? In other words, the gross acceptance of profane and obscene language as part of our culture, as it were. And then, because we are verbalizing this inner degradation, it then takes the more extreme form of pornography.
I think there's a connection with the widespread acceptance of foul language. I think that is, in a sense, diminishes us, makes aggression in social interaction more acceptable.
You see, like in the playground, for example, kids learn swear words in the playground, and it becomes part of their macho image, and also women's macho image, so that women and girls are very capable of using swear words, etc.
Yeah.
Now, by the time they reach their teens, they then are in a position to enact what they've been verbalizing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, it becomes a lust and an addiction, as you say. And so it seems to me that we're really not dealing rightly if we're dealing only with what is. We're chasing ambulances again. If we're only dealing with what is, we've got to get right back to the cause. And it seems to me there may well be analogy with the AIDS virus, whereby AIDS, it is suggested in some circles, is not the real trouble. The real trouble is the rundown system in which AIDS can take its toll. That, like a TB infection or whatever, it's just a rundown system.
Right, well, I mean, I agree that trying to restrain pornography is only sort of part of the problem. I just think that it's worth doing, because I think that law has doesn't, as it were, make people good. It can restrain evil. And I think, obviously, what is going to get to the heart of it, or what is going to get closer to it, is, for a start, that all Christians should demonstrate really a happy and fruitful and good attitude towards sexuality, so that there's a very positive witness to sexuality and to marriage and to family life and to a sort of emotional wholeness and warmth. That is the area in which Christians perhaps have the greatest responsibility, as well as witnessing generally to the truth of the gospel. But it must be demonstrated in this whole area of family and of sexuality and marriage. And then I think that then they must campaign against this distorted kind of sexuality and fight against it. I think Christians, one thing that Christians can do, and this is what I've suggested to CARE, is to demonstrate that one's not necessarily against all kinds of sexual explicitness. I suggested to CARE that they should set up a fund which would be a prize, an art prize, for the best painting or sculpture which dignified human sexuality. Just to give you an example, in All Hallows Church in London, there's a most beautiful female nude surrounded by children, sculpture. Just wonderful, just lovely. Which really affirms human dignity and human worth. And I think that in some senses, I'd like to see every nasty girly magazine banned from every newsagent in the country and every town and village. But I also like to see in the square a beautiful nude statue to replace it, you see, which really affirmed human sexuality and human dignity. So I think we have to attack the whole thing more generally. I haven't taken up my suggestion yet. They've got to get that across to their at least one person was keen on it there. But I think we have to, you know, do that as well. Instead, has there been any sort of off-the-shelf campaign up here?
I know Noel Todd at one time was involved in seeing to the closing down of a shop.
Right. The feminists are doing this off-the-shelf campaign. You go into W.H. Smith, you take all the girly magazines off the shelf, you put them on the counter, you call for the manager, and you say, open it all up, and you say, why are you selling this? Now, we did that.
Did you really?
Our group. Our care group, not as a care group, because this is not an official care thing,
no.
But I got together with another Libri worker and two other women, three women, and myself. And we went into Farnham, W.H. Smith, and we went into Guildford, W.H. Smith, and we took all the stuff off the shelf. And W.H. Smith is the mildest, but W.H. Smith is the biggest market leader, and it's the one that gives sort of greatest respectability. We took all the stuff off the shelf, opened it all up, at the worst material. I said, why are you selling this? And it's most effective. We had our press releases out. We were on the front page.
Oh, really?
The manager of the shop.
No, we got on the front page in Guildford, and we got into the other local paper in Farnham. Now, the one in Farnham, the manager there was, you know, it's company policy. And I think he thought we were going to spray the shop, you know, or... sort of, you know, I think he thought we were a bunch of feminists who were going to attack him. You know. debag him and sort of hang him from the ceiling or something like that for being guilty of chauvinism or something.
I think in Sunderland there was a group of women went into a supermarket which they knew sold nasty videos, and they actually filled their trolley with goods and got to the cash out.
Yeah.
You know, they were going to spend possibly £50 or £60.
Yeah.
And then they'd have somebody planted to bring one of these videos, and they said, oh, I see you sell these, right, you can take everything back. We shan't buy here anything here anymore. Mm-hmm. I think it was a group of them did that.
Uh-huh.
I don't know whether it had any...
Well, we've been encouraged. We did apart from doing that, we did a survey a couple of years ago in our town. We got 14 women from our church working in pairs on a Friday afternoon and a Saturday morning, an hour each, just doing a questionnaire, six-question questionnaire. You know, what do you think of pornography? Do you think it's related to women being less safe on the streets? Do you think it should be available in the schools? And is it doing harm, et cetera, et cetera? And we got 400 women answer this on a Saturday morning in a little market town of Petersfield, and for an hour on Friday afternoon. And we got three quarters of them saying they thought it was damaging, that it was unhelpful, they were offended by it, and 63% who were willing to see it banned by law. It was really quite encouraging. And I think that a lot of women feel unable sort of to do something about it and sort of need to be given the encouragement of feeling that you can do something about it. And this stuff, you know, this stuff is garbage, this stuff is crass and ridiculous stuff and unhelpful, and, you know, we shouldn't put up with it.
The trouble with targeting a retailer, especially the corner shop retailer, is that you're only picking up the petty crook. The big people are the distributors.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And the retailer's defence is that he has to take all this porn, because if he didn't take the porn from the distributor, he wouldn't get any other papers of any value and wouldn't get any...
That's not true. I don't think that's true. I've heard that, because in our town, in Petersfield, following our survey, but I don't think connected with it, I can't prove there was any connection, we had the one shop which had been the worst shop in the town for selling this stuff. There was a new woman manager appointed. I don't think a Christian at all. And she and all the other staff were women, as is mostly the case. And they said, we don't want this stuff. And they threw the whole lot into the dustbin and have stopped taking it since. And that then caused the shop opposite, because huge numbers of Christians were then encouraged to go in and say, well done, excellent.
Yeah.
The shop opposite also gave it up. And we had a lot of correspondence in the press about it. They seem to be able to choose whether they have it or not. I don't know. So I've heard that that reason given, but I'm beginning to think it must be an excuse. You know,
I wouldn't think it's an excuse myself, because I mean, retailers are having to count to pennies, and if they do not get a whole swatch of of stuff, then they're...
If they're actually forbidden from... But I wouldn't have thought it's in the interests of a wholesaler to say, because you're not taking my pornography, I'm not going to give you anything else. I mean, he still wants to sell
the other stuff. Well, it is a very closed shop as a business venture, and therefore the distributors are so huge that they can really call the shots. The other thing, of course, is to look at who actually owns the distributors. I don't know whether it... continues to own them, but the Telegraph Company, not in the corner of Black Days as is now, but the old Berry Days, they owned, were alleged to own, a pornographic set up there through their distribution.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know whether Conrad Black took that over and whether he continues it or not, but it seems to me that one really wants to get at the shareholders.
Yep. Well, the campaign against pornography actually have, because of what they've been doing up and down the country, have actually managed to get a meeting with the chairman of Smith's. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that meeting, the chairman of Smith's has agreed, first of all, to stock a book called, the one I was referring to, about relationship between sexual pornography and sexual crime.
Mm-hmm.
They've got Smith's to stock the book. They've also... said that they will bring further evidence to Smith's, which Smith said that they will consider. And Smiths are also open to the idea of putting all the girly magazines in opaque cellophane wrappers. Mm-hmm. And the Granada motor chain has now put all its pornography in cellophane wrappers so that you only see the title.
Because the manager of Smiths was on the radio not so long ago defending his position. I think it's since Christmas.
Chuck Paul Hornby, was it? Was it the chairman?
I can't honestly remember. Yeah. It was a sort of snippet that I heard in an interview on the radio.
Right.
But he was definitely defending the maintenance of his current policy.
Right. Curiously,
they only stock three titles.
Yeah, they only stock three titles.
But
they're still pretty nasty stuff.
I was going to make was that you give all these statistics about how it leads to crime and that. And in many ways, as you said, Smith deals with the softer stuff. The hard stuff is basically mail order, isn't it? And that's much harder to tackle, isn't it? That's where the Obscene Publication Squad come in, the work that they have to do, isn't it?
Right. I think what one has to do is you have to keep up the argument against pornography, admitting that some stuff is much worse than others, for two reasons. Partly you want to restrict the kind of material, which is available, which is sort of acts, I think, as a stepping stone very often, not always, but very often. But you also want to maintain public momentum against it, if only to ensure that the police enforce the existing law and that they don't just become lax about it. I think you've got to do both.
For the background philosophy, do you know the book Politics of Pornography by Rush Dooney?
I don't.
That's quite good, actually. In that, he basically starts off with a description of the Marquis de Sade.
Yeah.
And talks about his philosophy of, and shows to an extent how that philosophy of life has permeated our society.
Yeah.
Not only in the level of overt pornography, but some of our thought patterns in far wide ranging areas.
Right. If we think of ourselves as meat, then meat we will become.
Yes. Yeah. That's quite a good book. And another one, I can't remember who publishes it or who the author is, but it's called It's a Playboy World.
Uh-huh.
It's a paperback, small paperback, which I could let you have the details of if you wanted. But they're both very good for background.
Right. I haven't gone into the sort of the overall background, sort of cultural license, if you like.
Yeah, I realize that's
that needs to be mentioned. That's a good point. The sort of the hedonism and the materialism. And in a sense, you could see sort of pornography. The Page Three girl is our sort of secular Madonna, which is a sort of symbol for the new paganism. modern day hedonism is just old style nature religion with mod cons.
Don't you find it strange that the readership of the Sun is very often in public women? That women are quite happy to open the pages of the Sun and the Metro, for example.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the Sun is a very cleverly produced newspaper. I don't underestimate that newspaper. As far as I'm concerned, Rupert Murdoch is close to being a pimp. I don't mind saying that in public. I really think he is in what he's done, and not just him, but in a sense he's been a sort of trendsetter in that. But I think one of the depressing things is that sort of women accept this evaluation or this image, sometimes because they're complicit with it. They're complicit with it. Sometimes just because it comes part of the sort of prevailing ideology. This is what we are. This is how we see ourselves. This is what we... what has been interesting is that when the whole campaign against pornography started, because when Claire Short introduced her bill in Parliament in order to try and ban the Page Three and got laughed out by everybody, she got 5,000 letters saying, well done.
Marketing.
all from women, you know, overwhelmingly. And she felt that there really was a lot of anger amongst women at this kind of material, and particularly women objecting to the sort of material that's in the offices and, you know, factories where they're having to work, and where they're sort of made to feel they've got to accept this stuff.
And I think all the government offices have been taken down, hasn't it?
Have they?
Yeah, I mean, they had, a few years ago, they had different MPs targeted every government department and asked questions. What will the minister do about removing these?
Oh, really? Yes.
And you could just see it in every department.
Right.
Tackling, and I think that thing
right.
Take them down.
Right.
One thing that really frightens me is the fact that the famous Tainan word, which used to mean simply having sex, has now come to mean doing actual damage to somebody, messing them up.
Yeah.
I think that's a very frightening and insidious thing.
Right. Right. Well, I've always been interested, like, to point out to to people that the word screw means exploitation, usually. and yet it's never, you know.
Children use this word. And it
does
have a very strong effect.
I think it does. I think it does. I think.
Well, there was actually a TV schools program. It didn't use that particular word, but it used obscene language for the words.
Yeah.
It was shown at 11 o'clock in the morning on Channel 4. And it actually used obscene language. And I could never use it in school. What's more, my colleagues who do, if I was a teacher, who do swear personally, some of them do, many of them don't, would not use it either, even though they personally would swear.
Right.
They could never dream of using it. And yet the broadcasters were beaming it out for schools. And I wrote off to the Home Office, Channel 4 and so forth. The letter I got back was, well, you know, you've got to understand the context. It was two pages of A4. Explaining about the context and how important it was. You know, you should understand the context and the stresses that people be involved when they do express themselves like that.
And they should. And
they don't actually. I mean, I think this is an important thing that, you know, we're always told that people use this language. Well, they don't. You know, if they want a job, or, I mean, colleagues at work, I mean, only a few of them actually, you know, actually got involved in that sort of thing. Many people just didn't at all. Ordinary people. And always evil is portrayed to be more prevalent than it actually is.
In order to make it more acceptable.
To validate it,
yes. Yes, that is sometimes the case. If the film had been not targeted for young people, it's a very difficult thing. Do you actually edit what is out, what actually is taking place? I mean, if it was being for adults to watch that film only. So what I'm saying is, if you are to do a film of young people who do routinely swear in the playground, do you actually remove all that? Because it's a public film, if it's going to be shown to adults. Or do you include it, but have a proper perspective on it, rather than, in other words, making it acceptable? Do you describe this? Do you include this kind of material as part of this dehumanizing sort of playground jungle that you want to describe? It's difficult. Perhaps you don't have to. I mean, it's always difficult to know in order how much you include in order to be able to damn something, and how much, if you include it, you actually make it acceptable. It's a difficult balance to do that.
Great show, probably. I mean, which has been condemned for other aspects.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't actually come across. It comes across, in some sense, as realistic. They just have swearing on.
Right, okay, yes.
They seem to manage.
And it becomes perfectly credible, right.
Everybody knows, I mean, kids do swear. I mean,
right.
They don't need to be told that.
Right.
It's obvious.
Right.